This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing today?
Hey, good, good.
Excellent. Well, today on the show, we are going to be talking about child prodigies. We're going to get to catfishing, which we didn't get to last week, as well as a question from a listener about childhood experiences and overbearing parent. And then we're going to go with another listener's questions who has a congenital disease. And then if we can get to the next couple of questions, if we've got time, we're going to be talking about sibling birth order and then talking about death. So a couple of things that will lighten up our evening today, obviously. So, all right. Well, let's get started. Dr. Lyle, you ready to power through?
I'm ready.
Excellent.
Sure.
Okay. So here's a question from one of our listeners. Dear Dr. Lyle, what is the deal with child prodigies? 4-year-olds who can compose and perform music in a way that makes our jaws drop, or they might paint with mature skills. How does that happen? Are there cellular memories, like the way some species are born with the knowledge of where to find the feeding grounds of their ancestors? Or is this just some sort of scam that we see on pop psychology and TV?
All right. What it is it's simply the normal acquisition of skill. And it's going to turn out that the way brains are built, there are no prodigies in the way that that people might think. In other words, there are not people that are born with skill. That is impossible. The reason why I say that it's impossible is that the construction of the nervous system is such that it has to be very flexible about what motor skills that it can that it's going to learn. So the way, in other words, it doesn't know what kinds of motor skills it's going to need in order to efficiently navigate the environment. So it doesn't know that if it needs to get really good at picking blueberries, or it doesn't know that it might be needing to carve elephants out of wood. It doesn't know whether or not it needs to be throwing projectiles with accuracy. In other words, it doesn't have any idea at birth what on earth is going to serve this human best in terms of motor movements. And so it has to be very flexible. So that means it begins its life with essentially no ability at all. It barely has any control over what it's doing. It does have some control, but it doesn't have a lot. And so you can see this in walking behavior and in talking behavior. So they make a tremendous amount of mistakes. Look at a one-year-old as it's learning how to walk. It can do it, but it's not very good at it. And it will overexcite some muscles and underexcite others, and it'll get its timing a little bit off, and then it'll fall, okay? And so it's making mistakes all over the place. Now, what's happening is that as it exercises those capacities over and over again, it's actually doing something mechanically to the nervous system itself. And that is, as you repetitively contract muscles, or you have a neuron fire that contracts a muscle, what happens is that neuron, nearby cells that support the architecture of that neuron, that it's basically scaffolding in the nervous system, are called glia cells, which means glue, that sort of help the brain structure hold together. And what happens is that those glia cells, if nearby neurons keep firing over and over again because it's being used, then what happens is that the glia cells will manufacture a material called myelin, It's like a waxy type of a substance. It acts as an insulator, and it will cut itself into little sheets and wrap itself around that neuron. Now, when it does that, what happens is that it insulates that neuron, and an insulated neuron, just like an insulated electric wire, will not leak electricity to nearby neurons. So when you're watching a little kid learn how to walk, you're watching that it wants to fire some neurons, but the problem is that electricity is leaking to nearby neurons because it's not yet myelinated. And so that's why the kid overexcites things and then winds up falling on his rear end. This is precisely why this is happening. Now, the more and more it fires the neurons the way it wants and gets feedback that that's true, the myelin sheath will start wrapping around the neurons in a certain way so that when it wants to wiggle its right big toe, it can wiggle its right big toe and not wiggle its other toes. So this starts to isolate neural circuits in a way that the individual becomes much more accurate at activating, essentially contracting the muscles that it wants to contract and not contracting other muscles that it doesn't want to contract. So this is how you develop skill. Okay, so no human being is born learning to play a piano. Now, I've got a friend of mine that keeps swearing up and down that her son could just sit down and listen to some music and then play it. And he just could do this, and he's never had any lessons. Well, she's just totally lying, okay? And I haven't confronted her on it just because I don't want to, like, burst her bubble. But all she's really doing is telling me that her genes are so fantastic that she deposited these genes in her son, and her son at 10 years old is a prodigy, and he can just do this. Well, I know it's completely a lie. There's no way that it cannot be a lie. In other words, that child cannot have known how to move those fingers in a coordinated fashion in order to reproduce that music without having had a phenomenal amount of practice at doing it. It's simply not possible. You need to have a phenomenal amount of practice in order to myelinate those neurons so that when it wants to move those specific fingers, it's not leaking electricity to nearby neurons and therefore activating nearby neurons to fire and therefore fire off the other fingers, okay? It's simply not possible. So that's why anybody that has ever learned any motor skill understands that you must begin by doing it slowly and correctly, and you have to do it slowly and correctly over and over and over again. And as you do it slowly and correctly, what happens is you wrap the myelin sheath into creating neural circuits that they leak less electricity, and then they fire not only more accurately, folks, but they fire faster. So it's going to turn out that the more you practice, the more myelin you wrap. And if you look at a neuron of a highly wrapped, a highly used neuron, so for example, if you were to look at, Eric Clapton's, neurons around moving his fingers to play the guitar. If you were to look at those, you would find out that he has wrapped 250 sheets of myelin sheath around specific neurons, which is unbelievable. So that means that he's going to be able to move those hands with phenomenal speed and accuracy and not leak any movement to other nearby neurons. He'll be impeccable in those movements, as efficient as a human being can possibly be. That's what you're watching when you're watching a concert pianist. That's what you're watching when you're watching a master carver. You can't just wake up at birth and be a master carver. It's not possible. You must wrap the myelin sheath. Michelangelo, you couldn't have handed him a guitar and say, well, you're so good at carving marble that should be child's play for you to play like Eric Clapton. Why don't you just do this? Impossible. He would have to go through the very slow movements thousands and thousands of times in order to wrap the myelin sheath, in order to isolate those neural circuits. This is the nature of adaptive skill in humans. So you aren't born with these skills. You must adapt them by repetition. And the only way it works is by repetition. So there are no child prodigies that are born into this world that have any skill at all. When you're looking at a four-year-old that's really good at something, believe me, this had some parent breathing down its neck in all probability, making sure that it had the tools to do this thing, if it's a violin or it's a golf club, whatever it is. And it has all the time, it doesn't have to go work in the field and pick berries. this thing is firing these neurons over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And the kids that are that develop great skill by age four are actually kids that have some particular fascination with that movement. So in the case of Tiger Woods, he was just fascinated with hitting golf balls. In the case of Tara Lipinski, she was very interested in you know, ice skating. And so this is what it is. It's just child prodigies have simply spent the, in the case of, you know, not very many four-year-olds are very good, but they might be. Because from the time they're two, they can start doing these repetitive actions. And if they do those repetitive actions for, let's say, 1,000 hours a year or 2,000 hours a year potentially, some little crazy kid that just keeps doing this these movements over and over and over again, 8 hours a day for 365 days a year, they could potentially put 2,500 hours in. And in a couple of years, if they're they've got a rage to master, they could have put in 5,000 hours of repetitive actions. If they do this, they can have wrapped a tremendous amount of myelin sheath around certain movements, and they can be highly competent. They're not going to be as good as someone who's 10 years old and has been wrapping the myelin sheath for several years. They will not be as good. So everybody talks about how Mozart was this child genius, and at age four, he's writing music. But he was lousy at it. Okay, so he was, I'm sure, a fine little pianist, but being a pianist is an awful lot different than writing music. So Mozart wasn't worth a damn as a music writer until he got older, as that would make sense. He had a great deal to learn. So, yeah, the child prodigies do not have any, quote, cellular memories. That isn't how this works. They weren't born with any specific skill whatsoever. They may have been born, and probably were in a lot of cases, born with unusually good hand-eye coordination, for example, if that's what they're into. Or it isn't just hand-eye coordination. They're probably born with very coordinated nervous systems. So they might turn out to be a tremendous skateboarder, for example, et cetera. The world won't hear of them in all probability because we don't care that much about that. But they might. Or they might, if there's some Hawaiian kid, they might get out there and just surf like crazy and get extremely good at surfing and wrap a bunch of myelin sheath around those problems. So you can see that there is no mystery here. It's literally how much myelin sheath have you wrapped, and essentially the only way to wrap the myelin sheath is to earn it, and you earn it by repetitive actions focused very carefully on making the movements as accurately as you can and doing them hundreds of thousands of times. The great NBA All-Star Bernard King, in the 1970s and 80s, once gave an interview that said he actually intentionally knew that he wanted to add a new move every summer to his NBA repertoire. NBA players usually have a few go-to moves that they have done so many times that even if you scout it, it's happening so fast that the defense may not be able to react quickly enough to stop the move. And so Bernard King, you know, in trying to keep ahead of the game, and obviously because they're filming you and they're scouting your tendencies, so the players in the NBA all get to know each other and they get to know, you know, what the other person's go-to moves are and try to anticipate those and take those away and make them beat you with something else. Bernard had figured out that in order for him to get a new move ready for the NBA, it took 100,000 repetitions. And before it was NBA ready. So that's what he would do all summer long, is he would do 100,000 repetitions to bring a new move. And that is how you make an NBA All-Star.
Wow. This is really interesting. So, yeah, the myelin sheaths. So, you know, when I was in high school, I started learning magic. And, you know, it's just something to do. And it's really interesting. But what I noticed was, I was no longer interested in being a spectator of magic because it was just no longer fascinating for me.
Yeah.
So you see where I'm going with this. I'm wondering, Dr. Lyle, is this how you look at the world now where it's just not as fascinating because you kind of understand, you know, the myelin sheath. That's not the, you know, the fantasy of like some kid who just happened to have this cool nervous system that he just learned to do things.
Yeah. No, I'm respectful of people that have gone to the trouble to wrap the myelin sheath. And I now look at the NBA, for example, a sport that requires phenomenal skill. And they have to be incredibly unusual athletes. They have to be really tall. They have to be really, really quick. They have to have great endurance. They have to be strong. They also have to be mentally tough. They have to be extremely competitive. They have to bring a tremendous amount of unusual characteristics to the table, but that's not enough. They have to wrap the myelin sheath or they're going to be dead. So you can be 6'9", can jump really high, quick, tough, strong, willing, but if you have not wrapped the myelin sheath, you're probably going to be out of the league. And so you will sometimes, if you watch the NBA, you watch the speed of the movements and the skills that the players use, you are watching the myelin sheath. That's what's very interesting. So you're literally watching a chess game of the myelin sheath because the muscles and the bones that are involved here are just the mechanical operations by how it works. But what you're watching is you're watching the myelin that the person either earned or did not earn through repetitive actions, being very, very careful to not just goof around in the gym, but spend every minute that they could about wrapping the myelin sheath. And when people watch Steph Curry now and watch Klay Thompson and watch these phenomenal, once-in-a-lifetime shooters on the same team, you are watching the myelin sheath. Those guys didn't just happen that way. They have systematically learned how to shoot a basketball, better than other people have ever learned how to shoot it. And that did not happen by accident. That happened by design. And you will find that with the incredible amount of incentive that people have today, in the old days, 40 years ago, if you were a professional athlete, you made the equivalent of today what would be $250,000 or $300,000. In other words, it was a lot of incentive for people from lower and middle economic situations. If you had that kind of talent, that it was worth trying to pursue that because you could make a lot of money. For 5 or 6 or 7 years, you might make $250,000 a year. It wouldn't set you up for life, but it would be a very good situation. It's entirely different today. If you are a very fine athlete today in the professional ranks, it's very likely that you will come away with a fortune, between $25 and $50 million, and that's if you're just real average. So that kind of a fortune now, everybody on Earth knows that these fortunes are now astronomical, and now the incentive to wrap the myelin sheath is now through the roof. And so you are watching the development of skills triangulate on the maximum possible for human nature. And so I don't think I will ever see a better shooter in my life than Steph Curry. I don't think we will. In other words, I think he has probably wrapped the myelin sheath as well as it can be wrapped in a nervous system that is genetically has the sensitivity of feedback mechanisms to hand-eye coordination that is probably at the 99th percentile, if not better. His father, Del Curry, was an absolute phenomenal shooter himself, so the kid walked into the genetic game with probably 1 in 3,000 coordination. And then we wrap the myelin sheath brilliantly for 25 years, and this is what we get. That's the apex of humanity in terms of that particular skill. It's like watching an Arturo Rubinstein play the piano. It basically can't be done any better. Okay, so that's what it is. And so prodigies are fascinating because it stokes our concept that there's some kind of magic out there. But folks, there is no magic to great skill. What there is tremendously driven effort. That's what results in great skill.
Fantastic. All right. Well, before we get to our next question on catfishing, we actually have a caller on hold right now. Yeah. So I'm going to put them on.
Sure.
And,
sure.
All right, caller, how are you doing today? What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Rob calling from Boston, the place where Dr. Lyle's childhood dreams are crushed because of the Celtics.
That's just beautiful. Is it Rob?
Yes.
Yeah, Rob, very good. Yeah, go to hell, Rob. Yeah, now go ahead.
I talked to Dr. Lyle once, and he debunked this book called The Four Agreements, and I think it's worth just running over quick in the podcast for everyone to hear, specifically one part where Don Miguel Ruiz says, don't take anything personal, because I said to Dr. Lyle, well, he says don't take anything personal for something. Oh, someone's being mean to you, someone's crazy towards you. Oh, don't take it personal. But what if someone's, you know, being, you know, what if for the positive? Oh, so you can't take anything personal for the, but only take it personal for the good. It makes no sense. Dr. Lyle, can you please debunk this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I got so many questions about this book that I went online and looked at Wikipedia for about 2 minutes to look at it. Obviously, it's some little pop psychology deal. And so I read through it, and I don't really remember it very well. But the concept of don't take anything personal, in some ways, I could in some ways see a point of what someone is trying to be saying, which is something that I will try to encourage people in certain situations. But let me give you an example. So of what you're getting at and what I would get at. Let's suppose that you are being rejected in a romantic situation where you're interested and they don't seem to be interested in you. Now, in principle, we would say don't take anything personal. Don't take it personally. But how personal can it get? It doesn't get any more personal than this. This is what it's all about, is our genes are being rejected as not up to somebody else's standards. The how is it that we do not take it personally is like almost psycho to think that you could have that attitude. Now, you could have another attitude that would be slightly different, which would be to say that, hey, obviously I being personally and in an isolated fashion rejected by this human who is saying I am not up to their standards. Okay. However, I could take it in the following way, that this does not mean that everybody of that person's gene caliber will always reject me. In other words, this is not an objective assessment and rejection. This is a subjective assessment and rejection. And so I need to isolate out this feedback to this specific individual and not necessarily generalize it to all other such individuals. Now, the truth is that we should generalize it to all other individuals to a degree, because this is, in fact, an N of one, and this person is representative of the marketplace that we are seeking to trade in. And so, of course, it's going to impact our self-assessment to some degree. But that degree should be limited, and we should keep an open mind as to what it is that this means. So this is when we're young in life and we have not been rejected 50 times the way I have, the first few rejections can be at least 50 times. The first few rejections can be pretty tough on us, because particularly if we're expecting to be able to qualify, and we would only approach people if we would expect to qualify. And then it turns out that we don't qualify, and this can be hard feedback. This is going to be some ice cold water in our face. To have a smug concept of not taking this personally would be, of course, absurd. However, the other side of it is, of course, we're going to take it very personally, but we can also understand that this person is not the end-all, be-all authority of our gene value, whether it's with respect to our work or with respect to our friendship or with respect to our sex appeal and mate appeal, okay? That they're not the end-all, be-all judge, and although we will take the rejection as a cue that we may have reached too high, or we may have not reached intelligently enough, or maybe we just simply don't qualify for this specific individual. There's three very different hypotheses here. We want to consider all of them. But yes, it's not nearly as simple as the four agreements. But yeah, very good question, Rob, and thanks for calling and asking. Is there anything else we can do for you?
Nate, can I ask a real quick follow-up?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. I'll ask this and I'll hang up. Dr. Lyle, what do you think of the idea when I've heard many women say in my life, I'm 30, but I've heard many women say it, oh, I only go out, I don't go out to meet guys. I just want to go out and you know, dance with my friends and have a good time and have a drink. I don't want to meet anyone.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So what's going on here is the following process. There's all kinds of stuff that can be going on. But one of the things is that human beings are not necessarily at all, they're not even unconsciously motivated to do things and not be aware of them. It turns out that they simply like to do things that wind up being causally related to being successful genetically. And that's what they're going to call fun, okay? So it's going to turn out that guys like to wrestle, and they like to fight, and they like to do sports. And they at some point will start to figure out that if they get a bunch of glory from being successful, then the girls will ooh and ah, and it will increase their likelihood of, you know, they're going to increase their mating cachet. They do learn this, but the truth is that it could have been the case that the species could have been obtuse enough to not even know that that was true, and they would still like to do it, okay? They would just like to do it because it is, in fact, causally related, and it may never have developed a brain smart enough to understand why it's a good idea. It would simply do it because it's a good idea. I mean, because its success in that arena is in fact causally related to mating success. So with chicks and going out and hanging out with their friends at a bar and dancing and listening to live music, these chicks can be sufficiently obtuse as to not actually know why the hell they're there. Okay? That, of course, they like, if you were to ask, oh, then it probably, in that case, you probably don't pay any attention at all to what you look like when you go, and you probably doesn't even cross your mind. I'm sure you always forget your makeup when you're in this, when you're in a little bit of a rush, and you don't think the slightest bit about the clothes that you wear or your hair, right? Okay? This is insane. They are just like athletes, and this kind of thing is like the chick Super Bowl, and they're into it in the way that because this is an arena by which they display their sexuality, they display what it is that they have to trade. They may not actually want anybody in that bar, but they're interested in seeing if there is anybody in that bar or place. And whether or not the handsome one is making eyes at them, et cetera, or who the handsome one is making eyes at, they're doing all sorts of calibration activity. They are also doing coalition building and maintenance activity with their friends, so that can be an independent survival and reproductive issue. But, of course, there's a reason they are there and not at a picnic table out in the park. They're there where they are because they are in the middle of a swirling cauldron of sexual dynamics and feedback, and of course they are interested in getting hit on. So ridiculous, and you're right, and they're all lying. Okay, good job, Rob. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Rob. Really appreciate the call. Would love it when you call. Yeah, Dr. Lai, I was thinking about that too. Could the female in Rob's case, could she be signaling to him, you know, oh, look how conscientious I am, or look how humble I am. I'm not actually going to find mates. I'm just going to have fun. In other words, I'm not doing this intentionally.
So don't think
that I'm promiscuous or anything like that.
Yes, yeah. That's what I was going to say. It's actually a major signal to for someone in a relationship that's saying that, they're saying, oh, no, I'm not interested in fishing around for any other partners. But the truth is they're interested in going out there and calibrating. Okay, so calibration is a critical part of appropriate utilization of your resources. So that's like saying, like, oh, I'd never want to leave that firm, but I certainly will go talk to that other firm if they're calling me up and going to make me an offer. You know, can't hurt to talk to the guy. Okay, so that's certainly, of course, in the equation, and then the other thing that you're discussing there, Nate, which is that they would want to signal that they are not promiscuous, because being promiscuous would reduce their mate value as a pair bond, And so as a result, they would want to say, oh, no, 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 sexuality is not even on my mind. Okay. We know that sexuality is on females' minds because they're far more likely to wind up in places like that when they're fertile. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, we know that when they are fertile and they wind up at such places, they show more square inches of skin than when they are not fertile.
Mm-hmm.
So this cannot be happening by biological accident. So their minds and their behavior are actually biasing this behavior in such a way to be more sexually attractive, and the only reason to be sexually attractive is to dig up responses from males. So whether or not you follow through on those are irrelevant. The point is that there's an underlying biological process that's at work here, and people are not insensitive or blind to it.
Hmm. Well, speaking of minds and bodies,
yes.
Our next question has to do with catfishing. And so
yes.
This is our listener has actually witnessed their roommate who's catfishing men online, and she would use an attractive girl.
Okay,
I got a story
ahead.
To tell you about this. I got
sure.
catfished maybe about 2 years ago or so. I was,
yeah.
you know, met this girl online. She looked
yeah.
she looked attractive. And what was mm-hmm. the kicker was in her profile, she talked about how she was a vegan, how she works out 5 or 6 times a week, how she does marathons, how she, you know, all these things.
Yeah.
And I could see by her pictures, she was a little bit overweight, but it wasn't that mm-hmm. bad. So it was, you know, and, mm-hmm. and with all the things that she was doing, it just seemed like she was paying attention to her health. Well,
yes.
When I invited her out, we were talking a little bit, and I said, well, do you want to go grab a drink, or you want to go drink coffee? Now, I don't drink coffee, but I always offer it because, you know, that's kind of the normal thing to do. And
yeah.
she says, I don't drink coffee. I only drink water. and I don't drink alcohol. So I was like, oh, even better. You know, somebody who's
yeah.
very conscientious about what they're drinking. So I suggested mm-hmm. we go get some smoothies. So I get there and I'm on the corner and I, right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So mm-hmm. I'm on the corner. She comes to she's on the way and I'm texting her saying, oh, this is hard to find. She's walking up. And I didn't think I saw her, but there was this lady who's about maybe 90 or 100 pounds overweight. And
mm-hmm.
and she's smiling at me. And in my
yeah.
socially awkward moment, I look and I say, God, I hope that's not her. And I said it too loud. And
oh my God,
it was just terrible. I don't think she heard me, but yeah, it was not very funny.
We'll never know.
We'll never know. So anyway,
oh, that's a tough one. Yeah,
it's a
really tough situation. Yeah, I've been catfished probably half a dozen times in my life, and it's a tough situation, and the times I've been catfished was always about weight. You know, I've been on obviously first time match.com dates, and the person the pictures are 50 pounds lighter than the individual that shows up. I'm not, you know, it doesn't happen often, but it happens, you know, enough that these are very tough things. So let's continue on with this question, and let's mm-hmm. Try to get to our questioners, you know, what the root of the question is. Go ahead.
Okay. So this is about my roommate who's catfishing men online. She would use an attractive mm-hmm. girl's pictures to lure presumably more attractive men to talking with her, while in
mm-hmm.
reality, these men never would have been interested in her as she was severely overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, she had no intention of meeting the men in person, so I have a hard time understanding what would motivate her to continue catfishing. Speaking
mm-hmm.
generally, are women who catfish making an error in thinking that the more attractive man could fall in love with their personality first before revealing their subpar looks?
Mm-hmm.
As for my roommate, she's since stopped catfishing but has yet to find a suitable pair bound and is very picky with men. Is it possible that her past fishing trips have messed with her self-calibration mechanism because of the positive feedback she was receiving from the attractive males? How can someone retune this type of miscalibration?
Really good questions, and there's a few little suppositions there that we'll pick apart here for a minute. First of all, the catfishing is not a surprise. This is human beings essentially knowing that they're in trouble for a competitive situation. Let's take someone who is a six, they really would like to be with a 10. However, they know they can't be with a 10, but they feel like, well, I can settle for an 8. And as a result, they know that if they present themselves as they are, they're not going to get an 8. So if they present themselves as an 8, maybe they got a shot at an 8, and therefore that's how they're going to do this, i.e. false advertising. Okay? Now, makes complete sense. So people would be very motivated to do this. And knowing that that there is more to the story than just your looks, that a considerable amount of your mate value has to do with your mind, then it would make sense to try to at least engage somebody that would that you would be excited about. Try to engage them in dialogue so that they could see your insides and that they could fall in love with your inner beauty. So I have no doubt that this was part of this woman's motivation. She was probably also just curious about whether or not she could pull this thing off, and also curious about just being able to interact with highly attractive males and to understand them, et cetera. So this is part of this is being driven by what I call the myth of inner beauty, which is the notion that our inner beauty can trump our outsides, and that people, you know, that we can get a great deal of credit for the stuff that is inside of us. Now, there is a little bit of truth to the myth of inner beauty, but the myth is that it's a very big deal, and that is myth. It's also going to be the case that it wouldn't surprise me that a woman could make this mistake in a bigger way than a male would, for the following reason. And that is that for men, it is in fact true that they probably have a 20 percentile upside, that they can fish a little bit out of their league if they bring tremendous mental and psychological and financial assets. And so that's because men have a differential option with respect to how much they provision offspring. So males that could provision offspring a great deal and would provision offspring a great deal, that those males would be more valuable than a male who could not or would not. Okay, so females are looking males over not just from the genes from looking at the outside, but also from the notion of protection and provisioning, and therefore the male has an upside with respect to his inner beauty. Now, a female might infer behind the egocentric bias that she also has an upside to her inner beauty. This would be a mistake, okay? The female's upside with respect to inner beauty is very small, and the reason why it's small is because of the fact that men can count on women to be very, very high investors in their offspring. Now, this is not the same thing as the idea that a woman might find a male that's more handsome than she is and he might be into her. That's the notion of the subjectivity that sits inside these problems. That's different, okay? So that's a different issue. What I'm arguing is that women are not more sexually appealing because of their inner beauty and their psychology. They simply do not get ruled out behind psychological issues. Men will rule women out psychologically who, in fact, are acceptable physically. But if you have great inner beauty as a female, you will not get ruled out on that issue. And so, but it's not going to add points to your sexual appeal. So this, but females could make this mistake very easily, particularly in this case, I'm suspecting some narcissism in this girl. So I heard that the notion is that, like let's sort of look at what we heard. She was willing to lure men into this. She had some notion that this might work, et cetera. So it looks to me like someone who would be willing to pull this thing off and think that it might pull off. I think that she's got a narcissistic streak. So now we see that later she, quote, can't find a guy, and she's very picky with men. So the question on the table is, did the catfishing and all the positive feedback make her picky? My suggestion is that probably she was already very picky, narcissistic, had herself over-calibrated in the first place, got nothing but cold water thrown in her face in her own mating range, decided to catfish in order to get some positive feedback, hopefully sell the myth of inner beauty and try to snag somebody 20 or 30 percentile fancier than herself or 50 percentile fancier, didn't fly. So it fell flat on its face as a strategy, and now she winds up, you know, by herself with nowhere to go. So I think that this was a doomed enterprise from the beginning, probably driven by some narcissism. Now, the question on the table, though, is if you pulled such a stunt and got yourself potentially miscalibrated behind a bunch of positive feedback from people that didn't know who they were dealing with, would this potentially mess up your calibration mechanism? Maybe a little bit, not much, folks. The truth of the matter is that the whole point of calibration mechanisms is to be accurate. And so as a result, you could be potentially in a little bit of la-la land as a result of some sort of false feedback that you're getting for a little while. But you can retune a calibration mechanism in about 15 seconds by finding out that the next three guys you're interested in roll their eyes and walk away. Okay, so calibration mechanisms are pretty relentless, and they need to be, and they want to be. They set the bar high for us because they don't want us wasting our genes unnecessarily on draft picks that are potentially beneath us. So they set the bar high, and they set us up for a fair amount of failure feedback that we're going to have to endure before we finally find the person who is who has a subjective a rating system where we happen to qualify high in that subjective rating system. So that is how that works, and that's how we're built, and we're built to finally have mutual excitement when two people feel like they both killed the bear. Okay, that's how this works. But the system is capable of lowering our self-esteem or lowering our notion of our own, I should say more correctly, lowering our self's calibration of our mate value in the teeth of a bunch of repetitive negative feedback in order to get us calibrated lower so that we can be excited for a prospect that may, in fact, find us acceptable at some point. So that's how that would work. I.e., this is just, you know, put this in terms of money and a job. If the system, if you think that somehow you're worth $60,000 a year and you keep trying to get a job and everybody says, no, we'll offer you 42. And you keep trying to get 60, no, we'll offer you 43. No, we'll offer you 38. Okay? Sooner or later, when somebody offers you 44, you're pretty damn happy about it. You finally got it through your head. Okay? So you may have started out with lofty ideas about what it is that you thought you could get, but the feedback system will not allow you to go through this life and say, well, forget it. I'm not going to work for a dime under $60,000. It won't do that. When if you keep playing the game, the feedback systems will eventually calibrate you down. That is provided, of course, that you are making the best of your own job at presenting yourself well. If you know you're doing a lousy job presenting yourself and you've got more genetic chips to play but you're not playing them, then the system may sit right there and say, I'm an 8, I look like a 6, nobody's interested in me that's an 8, I'll just sit here and someday I may get my due, or someday I may get off my duff and, in fact, get myself out there in the game of the 8s and play with a full complement of tools. And so people can sit on the sideline, particularly in the pleasure trap, particularly with respect to being overweight or possibly underemployed if they're a male. Those two issues can sit there as essentially frustrating and energy-sapping goals that they don't want to put in the time and energy and commitment to traverse. And as a result of that, people can sit on the sidelines in this game of life for a long time. As a result of this. All right.
Interesting. So would you say that in terms of attractiveness,
yeah, go ahead.
If a female has gained too much weight, she is this the equivalent in males as being without a job or underemployed?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I think if let's say a young lady's 30, 34 pounds, 30, 40 pounds overweight. that would be the equivalent of a guy who could make $60,000 a year, but he's making $30,000. So he might say, well, I'm pretty good. I mean, it's not too bad. It's like, yeah, it's not too bad. But the truth is that you're not going to be able to play at the upper ranges of your trading ability at that level. Okay, you will not be able to. And if you're a woman that's 30 pounds overweight, or quite frankly, 20 pounds overweight, it's going to be very difficult for you to play at the upper ranges of your trading ability. So it's going to be harder for you to find somebody that you're excited about that is excited about you. And that's just the name of the game. That's how it works.
So my curiosity is I agree with you, and it makes a lot of sense about the character, you know, that men can overcome some of their lower attractiveness with some of their character and ability to provide.
Sure.
But I always think of a girl who might be super attractive, but if she's very narcissistic, low conscientiousness, mm-hmm. basically a total right. bitch, you know, mm-hmm. it doesn't seem like it would be a very pleasant person to be around no matter how looking she was.
Well, very true.
Whereas if you had a girl who wasn't that, you know, wasn't as attractive, but she was sweet and kind and honest and basically, you know, high conscientious, meaning, you know, she'd be taking care of her children and everything else as, you know, as best as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's my point. My point is that male decisions as to how attractive somebody is and whether or not that person meets threshold, those are likely to be fairly fixed decisions that seem to happen very quickly. So the male doesn't have a choice as to who it is that he finds attractive. Physically, mm-hmm. he just does. Okay. So these are sort of automated threshold decisions that are in the system. And so if you are below that male's threshold, I don't care what kind of personality you have. You're not, it's not going north. Okay. Now, if you sail over that guy's bar, but it turns out that you're an incredible, disagreeable bitch, the truth of the matter is that when he finds out you're an incredible, disagreeable bitch, eventually he'll let go of his fantasy. Okay? So you can rule yourself out by a bad personality, but you can't rule yourself in with a great personality. That's how that works.
So now, when you talk to women and you tell them,
it doesn't work the same way in reverse. So a male may not meet criteria when a female meets him. He is below her sexual interest threshold. But after she gets to know him and it turns out he's got a golden personality, he may meet criteria. Mm. So this is because females cannot know their own sexual responsiveness to a male at first meeting, because so much of a male's genetic value to her has to do with his psychology. She cannot tell when she meets him how kind, how reliable and responsible, intelligent and hardworking, and pair bond oriented he is. She cannot know this. However, each of those characteristics is a critical component as to how many resources her children by him will likely get. Okay? Mm. And so as a result, the female has to go through an assessment process in order to determine this. Now, a female can also meet a male who she finds screamingly sexually attractive and be interested immediately. All right, so she can have the same kind of immediate experience that a male does. But what she doesn't know, typically, is she doesn't know that she can have find somebody sexually acceptable once she discovers their inner psychology, and if it turns out they have great psychological assets, which most people don't have. Okay, but if the person has great, unusually strong psychological assets, it improves their sexual attractiveness with repeat exposure. It may or may not improve it enough to meet threshold for that female. Okay. But it might. And so this is something that females know this happens. They've had it happen to them. They've had some kid in art class that when they met him, they weren't into him. But after a couple of months of painting next to each other, he's such a nice guy. He's so pleasant and he's so committed to her and he really likes her, blah, blah. Suddenly she's finding like, well, you know what, this is a possibility. And he's funny and he's interesting and he's got some talent and hey, her nervous system, finally, he meets threshold, surprise, surprise. Well, the females have had that happen to them from time to time in life. And so as a result, they have often the inference that the same thing can happen the other direction. And this is where they make a mistake. So this is why our girl is catfishing, thinking that some man's going to fall in love with her inner beauty. You know, good luck. It's not going to. I'm not saying this is impossible. I'm just saying that I've never seen it. Whereas I have seen many situations where it goes the other direction, where the male was not immediately interesting to the female. He was below her threshold, and after she got to know him, her interest in him grew over a modest amount of time. That is well documented in the scientific literature, and it's been documented in my life experience doing therapy with a couple of thousand people. And so this is not an uncommon story from that direction, but the other direction is at best rare.
Mm-hmm. And do your clients who you explain this to, they get pretty disappointed that of the, it seems unfair, but I'm sure, I think it's fair enough, it works itself out, but
it's biology, biology is what it is. And this is all, this is all just the way that the game is set up genetically, and nobody has ultimately the upper hand. Everybody's got their own brutal, problems to deal with. And, it's not easy on anybody.
Fantastic. Wow.
Yeah. It's easier the more attractive you are, which is why it's no surprise that attractiveness is a significant predictor of how happy people are.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, only 17 more questions.
Maybe
to
just
go.
Pick one more. Okay. We'll pick one more.
All right, we're gonna take one with the congenital disease, and then we'll get to the other ones that I didn't get to next time. Okay, dear Dr. Lyle, here's my scenario. I have a congenital vascular disease that affects the size and appearance of my entire right lower extremity. My right leg looks similar to a port wine stained birthmark with varicose veins and is visibly larger than my left leg. But thanks to my plant-based diet, I'm very healthy. Other than pain and edema and swelling, I don't have many of the terrible complications that others do. I do, however, struggle greatly with the vanity of it, which seems to be worsening as I age. I'm fortunate enough that I don't recall getting teased or bullied for it during my life. Mm-hmm. I was never self-conscious throughout high school, but I began to feel embarrassed in my early 20s. Now I'm nearing my 30s, and I find that I'm becoming increasingly self-conscious and insecure about it. I never wear shorts, I never wear swimsuits in public, and I avoid social situations where my leg would be exposed, like going to the beach. It's affected my social life, and I don't feel confident that I would qualify for a pair bond that would excite my own nervous system because of the physical appearance of my leg. So two questions. Number one, how does this affect my ranking? If I'm otherwise a 7, does it make me a 5? And number two, how do I go about beating my genes in this situation, as it is a permanent disfigurement?
Okay. Great question, and a very interesting problem. And let's look at this. So we have the issue of the objectivity and the subjectivity. So this is an objective negative. There's no question about it. So the issue is that how negative it is going to be subjective for every single male. That's going to be looking at this. So one male is going to find this intolerable, and there's no way it's an instant rule out. Somebody else would find it a chink in your presentation, but not that big of a deal. Okay, where I could say, who knows, quarter of a point. Okay, so somebody else, it might as well be the whole enchilada. They can forget it. They're squeamish. They look at it. It bothers them. These are individual differences in humans. And this is exactly like trying to say, how bad is it if I put cilantro in your taco? If you put cilantro in my taco, it's like, send it back. Okay. I have no interest in this taco. I don't care how hungry I am. I don't care that it was made by, Juan Valdez, the wonder chef. Okay, who knows everything about Mexican food, and that taco is like $77. Uh-uh, I'm not interested. Send it back. Okay? Pack it up. I'll take it home and feed it to my cat. I'm not interested.
I'll take the cilantro.
Okay? So this is individual differences. And so what I would probably do if I was this person is I would encourage her, if she's, you know, trying to date on Match.com type of profiles, that I would comment on it in the profile. I would talk about who it is that you are, and I would talk about somewhere in this, a couple paragraphs down, I would say, you know, I have a congenital problem with one of my legs. It's not progressive or whatever it is, and this is what it is, and it's got these issues that she describes. Okay, and so, man, you know, some people, you know, find this some people find this difficult to or would be uncomfortable with this, and some people wouldn't. So, but I want to be upfront about this. And I would say this, and I would have maybe one picture where you're not in long pants, where they can see some amount of it. So we're not throwing it all over the internet for everybody to see and gawk at. But we have one picture where you may have a low-cut sock, and then you have a shorts that go about to your knee, or so, maybe a little above the knee, and you're sort of crossing your legs, or you've got two legs side by side, and you're sitting back with a, you know, mint julep or whatever it is that you're drinking, and that's what's going on. You got a couple friends. You might even cue people that by having a picture with two or three friends, that they're not looking at your leg and they're not freaking out, that they're just looking at you as a person and everybody's having a good time, but there it is, okay? Now, the truth is that if you do this, you will certainly reduce the number of responses that you get. However, there will be people who will look at this as an opportunity. Okay, as for example, I would. I'm always interested in somebody that's got some chink in their armor somewhere. And the reason is, maybe it's something I don't care so much about, but the rest of the market does. So there's jeans on sale. Okay? And so this is, I'm not the only one that thinks this way. And so this is, so when you say, how far does it hurt you? Does it take you to a 7 to a 5? No, I don't think so. I think it makes you if you're a 7, it makes you a bargain 7 for somebody is what it is. And so that's, but we want to access that market, and we don't want to waste our time trying to appeal to as many people as possible and thereby waste our time and then try to win them in and reel them in and get a relationship a little bit going before they find out we have this liability. That is a tremendous waste of your life. So instead, we're going to advertise more honestly, and we're going to do it in this essentially unashamed fashion, very adult, direct fashion. It's not front and center, and it's not front and center because it's not the most important thing about you. The most important thing about you is the rest of what you look like and who it is that you are, but we're going to put that in there, okay? And that way, when people contact you, they have been vetted for their ability to tolerate that issue, and now we are not wasting our time. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Talk about the difference between the catfishing and being dishonest, and now here
we're
actually being extremely honest and getting rewarded as a result because we don't waste our time.
That's correct. Folks, all you have in this life is you've got time and energy. That's what you have. And you are going to make, you know, if you make 50 decisions a day of any significance that are essentially decisions about how you're going to spend some of your existence, then that means in a lifetime you're going to make about 1 million decisions. And your health will largely depend upon the nature of those 1 million decisions about the ones that are related to your health. And your happiness will be pretty much related to the nature of those decisions, the quality of those decisions with respect to other issues in your life. And if we do a good job of being honest, we do a good job of working hard to achieve the things that we need to do in order to put ourselves in a good competitive standing, and we we do this solidly and we do this life well and we do it with integrity, then it's very likely that we will live a life that does a good job of optimizing our happiness potential. And so all we can do is to try to make good decisions so that we do not waste the opportunities of our time and our energy. And this is a perfect example of how it is that we try to do this well.
Fantastic, Dr. Lyle. Thank you again. We will speak to everybody next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.